This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, a New York City school teacher was fired for teaching about the case of the so-called Central Park Five.
Injustice has a ripple. First, these people were framed up and sent to prison, and now a devoted teacher in the New York City school system wants to talk about what happened to him, and she gets fired for opening her mouth.
We speak with retired Florida U.S. Senator Bob Graham about Saudi Arabia's possible role in the 9/11 attacks.
I think if and when the suppressed 28 pages of the report comes out, we'll conclude that it wasn't a possible role.
Professor Rashid Khalidi joins us to talk about Saudi sponsorship of Wahhabism.
This is the most fanatical, extreme, and violent version of Islam. What does this mean with respect to Saudi relations with Iran? What does it mean for Saudi relations with the United States? Give a listen.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
An English teacher at a New York City high school claims she was fired because of a lesson on the so-called Central Park Five that school administrators warned would, quote, rile up black students. Gina Lee Walker recently filed a lawsuit in federal court against the Department of Education and several administrators from the High School for Arts, Imagination, and Inquiry after being fired for insubordination and poor evaluations. She claims they were the result of her pushing back on topics like the Central Park Five. Lee Walker, who graduated from Barnard and has postgraduate degrees from Harvard and Fordham, began working at the school in 2013 and said she was told to be more, quote, balanced in covering the Central Park Five case in November of that year. The lawsuit claims retaliation against her violated her First Amendment right to discuss the Central Park Five case, and that the firing also violated the city's contract with the teachers' union because she was not given a required 60 days' notice. As listeners will recall, the Central Park Five, who were wrongfully jailed for the 1989 rape of a Central Park jogger, received a $42 million settlement from New York City. In 2014, they sued the state, seeking $52 million in damages for the emotional trauma of being incarcerated for years for a crime they were coerced into confessing to. Joining us today is Miss Lee Walker's attorney, Ambrose Watterson. Ambrose, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We were especially interested to learn about this case because we've covered other similar kinds of cases where teachers have taught things that really spark concern among the public and among students, but then they're retaliated against. If you will lay out briefly the details of this, was a film shown as part of the curriculum?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, there was a film shown as part of the curriculum about the Central Park Five. It's actually a fairly well-known documentary that she used as part of the class, and she would encourage discussion in the class. She's an English teacher, so the purpose of it was to get the students writing and to get them vitally engaged. And she says it was awesome. The students were very engaged. Most of her students were black and Latino students, and they were, you know, writing and having very, very good discussion.
And now the high school she taught at is the High School for Arts, Imagination, and Inquiry. And
right.
When I hear that name, I think this might be a progressive environment where creative thought and discussion is encouraged.
Well, unfortunately, it is not uncommon that the best ideas are not actuated, or the best ideas a lot of times is not exactly how the school functions. So, for example, that word inquiry would lead you to believe that the school is progressive, and maybe it started off being that way, but in no uncertain terms, she was told to, quote-unquote, be balanced. And her first response was, well, how do you be balanced on something like this? The facts are the facts. So
now, did any of the students complain about this
subject? None of the students complained. None of the parents complained. the complaints came solely, from what we understand, solely from high-level administrators. That's it. No one else complained. In fact, if anything, students were very interested, and there was quite a buzz about the class.
And engaged.
Correct.
So Miss Lee Walker wasn't given a hearing or the, I think, 60 days required notice.
That's correct.
And she was terminated.
That's correct. Typically, for probationary teachers, you at least have 60 days notice. And the idea is maybe you can improve your situation, although I'm not so sure 60 days is enough to do that. But you do have an opportunity to, you know, contest, what the officials are saying. She was given literally less than 2 weeks' notice about her termination. And so that's one of the causes of action, our complaint. We've got a due process claim pending as well.
Now, what I find shocking about this is that these are five young defendants, well, not so young now because they were incarcerated.
Oh, yeah, they're men now.
They're men.
Yes.
And we've seen the film and we know some of the lawyers in the case, but the city paid out a huge settlement to these men.
$40 million.
So it's not as though, exactly, $40 million. Mm. It's not as though there wasn't fault that in the environment that we're faced now with the criminal justice system being under a lens for racial issues. I just find this a surprising development.
Well, what's the law, Ambrose? Why can't a teacher exercise her free speech rights to talk about her opinion and teach a class on her opinion on this terrible injustice?
Sure. Well, first of all, the teachers are allowed to do that. But in 2006, there was a Supreme Court case, which most of us are familiar with. I'm sure you're familiar with it, Garcetti versus Ceballos. And that was a case where the Supreme Court said you do not have a First Amendment right if you are a civil servant and you're talking about or complaining about something that is part of your job. So in the Ceballos case, you had an assistant district attorney who complained to the famous Gil Garcetti of the O.J. Simpson fame, complained to Garcetti that there was a police officer who seemed to not be telling the truth. He wrote a report, and he was retaliated against by termination because he wrote the report. The Supreme Court said, nice try. That's not a First Amendment case. It was your job to report on police corruption or police lying. So you have no First Amendment. Too bad. So all the courts in the various district courts in the United States have sort of taken the position that, you know, if you are making a complaint and you're talking about something that is expected as part of your job, it's not a First Amendment complaint. So, for example, if a teacher complains that, for example, her special education students are not being taught properly or they're not getting services, it's not a First Amendment claim. She's expected to complain. Now, what's interesting, though, is the Supreme Court actually carved out an exception in the Garcetti case. They specifically said that their decision did not apply to academic freedom. And so here we have the exception. This is a situation where not only was she teaching about a matter of public concern, she had some fairly shrill discussions with her supervisors about their political differences as to Miranda rights in the Central Park Five.
Now, from the articles that I've read, it was stated that the authorities in the school said, quote, they didn't want to rile up the students. And does your lawsuit address any of that?
Yes, it does. Understand that this happened just as Black Lives Matter movement started. And so there may have been some concern that it might rile up students. I think that's kind of ridiculous. I think you want to have students who are engaged and who, you know, have some independent thought. But, you know, she was essentially told that we don't want any kind of little mini riots, anything that we can't handle, and it's kind of ridiculous.
There's a disturbing racial a stereotype there, though, mm-hmm. that persons of color, young students, African-American, Latino, would get riled up in
right.
response.
Or that they wouldn't be mature enough to have a mature discussion about this. But
Ambrose, so what's the legal basis of your lawsuit? Why shouldn't they be allowed to do this to this woman?
Well, we brought it under the First Amendment, Section 1983, as you're probably familiar with, which allows individuals to sue government As a public school teacher, she's a governmental employee. And to the extent that you had governmental employees, people who were acting in color of state law, telling her that she couldn't do this and then fired her, that would have been a violation of her First Amendment rights. So it's we brought the two causes of action under due process, the 14th Amendment, as well as the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
Now, I also read that some of her performance reviews after this film and discussion were had started to decline.
That's true. Hmm. Understand, this is also a woman who has a stellar background.
She went to Harvard, didn't
she? Yes, that's correct. She's always done well, and she started off doing well. And the timeline is such that you don't start to see complaints until this occurred. And they start off with, like, really, really minor complaints. I'm not going to, you know, go into the specific facts, although that's pretty much laid out in her complaint. But they started off with minor complaints about things she didn't do or things she didn't complete on time. And then it elevated to, you know, just very, very poor performance reviews. So it's our view that those performance reviews are pretextual, and what's really going on here is that they didn't like the fact that she was so vocal.
What does Ms. Lee Walker hope to gain from the suit? Does she want reinstatement of her position?
This is a woman who it doesn't seem that she's looking for money or that's not what's driving her. Her passion is teaching, and while she's doing some tutoring now, she's not in the classroom setting. This is a woman who was actually working on her PhD at the time and decided she wanted to be a little bit more practical and she wanted to give back, not later, but now. And so she elected to start with the New York City, you know, school system. So she would like some sort of reinstatement. She wants to be back in the classroom.
Ambrose, I wanted you to reflect on this contrast. In Chicago, where police commander Burge tortured over 100 black men into false confessions, and was later put in prison for lying about this. In Chicago, there have been reparations paid now. The city council has decided to help these men, and they've also agreed to provide free college education for them, psychological help for them. And this is what's relevant to your suit, I think. They've agreed to put a curriculum into the Chicago high schools to talk about this kind of police abuse. And contrast that to New York City, where they won't even rehire this poor woman for bringing to light a case of gross injustice.
Yeah, that is quite a contrast. We're still very early in the case. We filed suit last week, and almost immediately I got telephone calls from, you know, various members of the press regarding the suit. So, you know, whether or not this is a matter that is eventually resolved amicably with the city accepting or recognizing that indeed this is the kind of teacher we want in our classroom, I don't know. But it is quite a contrast between what you pointed out that happened in Chicago and what's currently happening here.
Of course, in Chicago, there's a movement. There are people pressuring the city council. There are people in the streets. There's coalition. There was a lot of citizen involvement. It just didn't drop from a tree. This reparations was forced on the government. I'm hopeful that there'll be some kind of public support shown here in New York for Ms. Lee Walker. If our listeners want to get involved in this, what should they do?
Well, there's a couple of things. You can certainly call my office, which is 646-242-3227.
Repeat that, please.
Sure. 646-242-3227 or 609-598-0567. As far as I know, there hasn't been any organization or movement yet. I've seen a couple of hashtags, things like Gina Lee for president, things of that sort. But there's been a real outpouring, at least online, there's been a real outpouring of support. I do agree that typically good cases should have some sort of backbone of political support, because when the case dies or it settles, you want to make sure that there's some legacy, and you want to make sure that somehow people are continuing to organize around that issue.
Well, we are thrilled to have you here in the studio with us. We wish you the best of luck, and we'd like to stay in touch and follow this case.
Glad to do so.
Ambrose, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Retired U.S. Senator Bob Graham from Florida is the former head of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. He's also the leading person trying to get President Obama to release to the public the suppressed 28 pages of the 9/11 report, which until now had been hidden. Senator Graham contends that the 19 hijackers, 15 of whom were Saudi Arabians, could not have pulled off the operation alone, and that in fact they were part of a support network involving the Saudi Arabian monarchy and government, which helped plan, pay for, and execute the complicated 9/11 plot. Senator Graham said otherwise it would have been impossible for them to accomplish this. Senator Graham has written the book called Intelligence Matters, The CIA, FBI, Saudi Arabia, and the Failure of America's War on Terror. It provides a candid insight to the workings of the U.S. in Saudi relations and their implications on U.S. foreign policy making as it pertains to the Middle East. Senator Graham, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to start by just asking a bit about your background, where you grew up, what the influence of your father was, and what positions you hold in the U.S. Senate.
I grew up on a dairy farm about 25 miles northwest of Miami. I was very influenced by my surroundings, which were the Everglades, a passion of mine. I was very much influenced by my parents. My father was a very wise man. He was also a very high integrity person and had run and been elected to the Florida State Senate in order to be a factor in cleaning out some of the corruption which had afflicted South Florida during the post-World War or pre-World War II period. That was a significant influence on my subsequent decision to pursue a career in elective office, and I frequently used the examples and lessons that I had learned from my parents in various political decisions that I had to make.
Senator, you served on the 9/11 Commission when you were still in the Senate, and you've said in the past that you became disillusioned. And I wanted to ask you, why was that?
Well, I did not serve on the 9/11 Commission, which was a citizens' commission. I co-chaired, as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the joint inquiry of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees into 9/11, with particular focus on the role of the U.S. intelligence agencies. After we finished our inquiry, which was in December of 2002, the Citizens Commission accepted our voluminous materials that we had developed and an over 800-page report, and they commenced their investigation, which went beyond the Intelligence Committee to a number of other agencies, such as the role of the Federal Aviation Authority.
Senator, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabians. Do you believe they could plan, pay for, and execute the complex plot of 9/11 involving hijacking of airplanes without external support?
Absolutely not. These 19 people, most of them did not speak English. Most of them had never been to the United States before. Most of them were not particularly well educated. That they could carry out a plot of this sophistication over a time period, which for some of them was 18 months, and avoid detection is implausible. That's the word that the chairs of the 9/11 Commission have used to describe this matter. It is implausible to me that the United States government, 15 years later, still clings to the position that these 19 people did in fact operate alone without any external support, and therefore their inquiries have, in my opinion, been very unnecessarily truncated because they haven't gone into the question of who were the groups that supported the 9/11 hijackers, because they don't believe they exist. U.S. government does not believe that an external support network exists.
And specifically, who do you believe that external support network consists of?
Primarily Saudis. As you stated, 15 of the 19 hijackers were themselves Saudi nationals with government involvement, were the primary funders of al-Qaeda and continue to be a primary funder, as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said during her tenure, that the primary source of funding of terrorism was Saudi Arabia. And I also, Saudi Arabia has been the principal promoter of this extreme form of Islam called Wahhabism, where young people are taught intolerance, jihad, and encouraged to act out against non-believers, and therefore have provided a steady stream of fresh recruits to terrorist organizations, from al-Qaeda to now ISIS.
Senator, why do you think that the United States government ignored the warnings that something terrible was going to happen prior to 9/11? And then my next question is going to be, why haven't they been more forthright in discussing who might have done it afterwards? But let's talk about before 9/11. Isn't it true that the president gets a daily briefing, and mightn't he have been warned about this?
Yes, and he was. The 9/11 Commission developed the concept, it was a lack of imagination, that we knew a significant amount about al-Qaeda and about what its intentions were. They had tried to hijack airplanes in the Philippines several years before 9/11. They had been the primary operatives in the attacks on two U.S. embassies in Africa, so they were not an unknown adversary. But with all of that, we didn't have the imagination that they might be plotting to attack not thousands of miles away on another continent, but attack in the United States and use as the means of that attack the same technology, commercial airliners, that they had tried to use in the Philippines.
After the attack, there's 28 pages of the report that haven't been released. And I know that you're under constraints and can't talk about what's in those pages, but I know you've written a book called Keys to the Kingdom, which is a novel about that. And I wondered whether you might talk about the novel so we could try to understand what's been suppressed.
First, about the 28 pages. The final report that was submitted in December of 2002 was over 800 pages. One chapter of 28 pages was totally redacted, and that chapter has been publicly acknowledged as primarily dealing with who financed 9/11 and pointed a very strong finger at Saudi Arabia, not surprisingly. I wrote a book called Intelligence Matters, which is a nonfiction book about the before 9/11, during, and then the investigation afterwards. There was a significant amount of that book which was censured. I was frustrated by that, and while I was a senior fellow at the Kennedy School, one of the faculty members suggested that I could tell the stories that were excluded from the nonfiction Intelligence Matters by writing it as a novel. So that was the origin of Keys to the Kingdom. I say Intelligence Matters, ask the questions, and Keys to the Kingdom gives the answers.
Senator, tell us a bit about the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandor. Why did he get President Bush to allow over 100 persons to fly out of the U.S. right after 9/11 before they could be questioned?
He had a very personal relationship with the Bush administration and with President Bush himself. The Bush family has been close to the House of Saud going back to the grandfather, Prescott Bush. So when the ambassador called the White House in the hours immediately after 9/11, saying he wanted to meet with the president. He was accommodated. They met in the White House. Prince Bandar said that there were many elite Saudis in the United States. It happened that at that time in Kentucky, the horse sales were going on, and that had brought together not only Saudis who lived in the United States, but Saudis from around the world, and that he, Prince Bandar, was concerned that they were going to be harassed, and asked the president for permission, even though most of American aviation was grounded at the time, if he could get a chartered plane to fly these Saudi elites back to their home in Saudi Arabia. The president agreed with that, and a few days later, after collecting Saudis elsewhere, chartered plane flew from Lexington, Kentucky, to Saudi Arabia with approximately 145 elite Saudis, including members of Osama bin Laden's family, back to Riyadh.
Whoa. Let's talk about Osama bin Laden, if we might, Senator. Bin Laden was, of course, from one of the elite families in Saudi Arabia. And there's been speculation that he told the government that he was willing to cause civil unrest in that country, that he was unhappy about certain policies that the government was carrying out, particularly with respect to the United States. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, the background to that goes to the first Persian Gulf War, the one that was in 1990-91 when Iraq had invaded Kuwait. Bin Laden had just come off being a major factor in defeating the Russians in Afghanistan and had some 30,000 war-hardened veterans at his call. He went to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and said, I can protect the kingdom from Saddam Hussein. You don't need to call on the Europeans or the Americans. The king at that time rejected bin Laden's offer and, in fact, did invite the United States and the Europeans, who in the early period of 1991 routed the Iraqis from Kuwait. Bin Laden never forgot that slight. At some point later in the 1990s, when he had returned to Afghanistan and was beginning the planning for what became 9/11, he became aware that this was going to be a very complicated process. I mean, compare what happened in 9/11 to what happened in Paris recently. The complexity of hijacking multiple airlines at the same time, having people who were technically capable then of flying the airplanes, being able to identify the targets and hit them in a very compressed period of time, were daunting challenges. Bin Laden figured out that these 19 people, with their linguistic and cultural limitations, were unlikely to be able to do that, and so he went to the kingdom and said, we want your support. I'm not saying that he specifically told the Saudi royal family what his ultimate plan was, but that he was going to have representatives of Al-Qaeda in the United States, and they needed to have people who could assist them, provide financing, give them access to some of the services that they would need, such as flight training, and protect their anonymity, and that if the kingdom didn't do all of the above, he would unleash his 30,000 warriors and start a civil war in Saudi Arabia. The kingdom capitulated and made available to the bin Laden a network primarily based on people who had been representing Saudi Arabia surreptitiously in the United States to oversee young Saudis, college age principally, who the kingdom were concerned might be plotting against the kingdom in the same way that college students had overthrown the Shah of Iran. A complicated story, but Bin Laden played the piano of all of these different people, histories, values, concerns, very well, and the kingdom made available to him what he'd requested, and I don't think 9/11 would have happened but for that.
Is that the reason you think that this has all been covered up?
Why it's been covered up by the United States government is another mystery. It's easier to answer the question for the Bush administration. I mentioned earlier the close personal relationship that the Bush family had with the House of Saud. Oil was another consideration. When President Obama ran in 2008, he ran on a platform of opposition to the war in Iraq. There was a lot of expectation that he would reverse these policies of non-disclosure of information about 9/11 when he became president. And in fact, and I can't say this firsthand, but it's been reported that President Obama told some of the families of the victims of 9/11 that he would release these documents. And now, in his eighth year as president, it hasn't happened. I'm an optimist. I still hold out hope that before January 20th, 2017, that President Obama will deliver on that promise that he has allegedly made and make all this information available to let the American people know what's the nature of our relationship with Saudi Arabia and be part of the decision-making process as to what should we do about it.
Senator, what are you doing now to secure the release of the suppressed 28 pages?
Well, there are a number of things which I hope are going to contribute to President Obama deciding to release these. One of those is this considerable amount of media interest, which had been dormant up until about a year ago. Now there are regular stories and reports much in line with what we're talking about today. Also in the Congress, there is a resolution to ask the president to release specifically the 28 pages on who financed 9/11. I think there's growing pressure for a release, and I hope it'll reach critical mass in the next 12 months.
The government of Saudi Arabia has been sued on behalf of wrongful death suits on behalf of the family of people who were murdered in the towers. They put up a defense of sovereign immunity. Can you talk about that?
Yes. First, it's very interesting that they have used the defense of sovereign immunity not just to protect the kingdom, but to protect a whole series of charities, foundations, religious institutions, all of which have been alleged to have been involved in some phase of supporting the 9/11 hijackers, primarily financing. Then the Saudi government says, although we use sovereign immunity to protect all these groups from litigation in a U.S. court, we, the kingdom, were not involved in any of these things, and therefore you can't sue us, right? You can't have it both ways. You can't say sovereign immunity applies to non-governmental groups and then say, but the government itself, which is using that defense, is immune. The status is that under the current law that governs suits against terrorist groups by U.S. citizens in U.S. courts, it's almost necessary to make your case beyond reasonable doubt before you can even get a hearing. And what has happened is that on several occasions, the families of 9/11 victims have been dismissed from court. And I'm sad to report the U.S. government has supported those dismissals. Now the Second District in New York City has reversed at least one of those dismissals, and the case has been refiled, and it's working its way back through the system. And in Congress, there's an effort underway to change the law so that it's not so onerous, and plaintiffs representing persons who have been killed or otherwise adversely affected by terrorists can get their day in court. I hope that this Congress will pass that. It almost passed at the last Congress, and I am optimistic again that that the Congress that's seated today will make adjustments to the law so that it will be more rational for American citizens to find justice.
Senator Bob Graham, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you if you have any final thoughts on this before we have to say goodbye.
Yes, maybe the most persuasive argument to Americans to keep all these materials disclosed is national security, that in some way it would have an adverse effect on our safety if this information were made public. I think it is absolutely the opposite, that the fact is that we have sent a message to Saudi Arabia that they can do anything with impunity, with absolute assurance that they will not be sanctioned. And that fact of the message of impunity through the unwillingness to disclose information in the possession of the United States government about Saudi Arabia's action at 9/11 has encouraged Saudi Arabia to continue to support terrorist groups, now ISIS, and to continue madrasas and mosques, which shape the young minds of Muslims so that they are prepared and religiously motivated to want to fill the ranks of ISIS or other terrorist organizations. So to me, our national security is being dramatically adversely affected by the way in which we have related to Saudi Arabia for its support for the 9/11 hijackers. I think it's an outrage, and I hope that the Obama administration will not leave this as their legacy.
Senator Bob Graham, it's really been an honor for us to have a person with your intelligence and courage on Law and Disorder, and we thank you so much for being our guest.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your carrying this message to the people of America.
Thank you, Senator.
Best of luck.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Report on Saudi Arabia and its relationship to the United States, we speak today with Professor Rashid Khalidi. Professor Khalidi will speak about Saudi sponsorship of the extreme religion Wahhabism, sectarianism, the Islamic State, and Iran-Saudi conflicts which entangle the United States. He teaches at Columbia University, where he is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies and the head of the Middle East Institute. He is the author of a number of books, most recently, The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood. He has written more than 80 scholarly articles on Middle Eastern history and politics, as well as op-ed pieces in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the Nation magazine.
Rashid, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be back on again.
Rashid, with respect to the religion of the Saudi Arabians, Wahhabism, why does the Saudi Arabian government sponsor this, and what's it like?
Well, Wahhabism, which the Wahhabis themselves hate to be described as, they talk about it as Tawheed, and they call themselves Muwahhidun, is a particularly narrow, intolerant version of the most ascetic and extreme of the four major Sunni schools of Islam. And it is a version which focuses obsessively on the worship of God and which argues that anything that takes away from that, adornment, veneration of the family of the prophet, and so on, is not just a bad thing, but is actually anti-Islamic. It involves disbelief. And it goes further in saying that those people who have strayed in this way have ceased to become Muslims and therefore have become apostates and are therefore liable to the most extreme sanctions, including execution. That is the core of Wahhabism. It is an extremely intolerant, extremely narrow, in my view, personal view, extremely bigoted understanding of Islam, which represented a very tiny minority view among Muslims in the 18th century when the Sa'di dynasty adopted it as a sort of a battle horse for their dynastic ambitions. And so the Al-Sa'ud, the Sa'di dynasty, and this peculiar extreme version of Islam have been allied now for well over 250 years.
Do you have any estimate of the numbers of persons who practice this, and are the numbers growing?
Well, it was a tiny, tiny, tiny minority, even within the Arabian Peninsula, until the Sa'di dynasty conquered the rest of what is today Saudi Arabia. Most of Saudi Arabia followed much more tolerant, much more open-minded, much less bigoted interpretations of Islam, whether we're talking about the Hejaz, where Mecca and Medina are located, the Asir, the Jabal Shammar region in the northeast. Most of the country followed very broad-minded, relatively, interpretations of Islam. So it was a tiny minority. It was imposed as the only orthodoxy within Saudi Arabia by the regime as it took over the country in the 20s and 30s. And the problem was pretty much confined to Saudi Arabia. And in fact, Wahhabism may not have been, believed by most Saudis even then, because many of them probably still clung to their more tolerant, open-minded beliefs. The problem comes with the petrodollars of the 1970s, and with the Saudi government aggressively spreading its ideology through the financing of mosques, madrasas, and Islamic centers, to which the condition was attached that everybody associated with them had to follow, had to be trained in Saudi Arabia or follow their line of thinking. So it has grown and grown as an element among practicing Muslims.
In line with the extreme intolerance that you're talking about, Rashid, to open up the new year on January 2nd, the Saudi government beheaded 47 people, including Sheikh Nimr, and he was a Shia. And I wanted to ask you about your reaction to that. What do you think the significance of it is?
I think it's very grave because the Sheikh was a radical in the sense that he strongly opposed the monarchy and had called for its abolition. And in Saudi Arabia, that's treason and is punishable by death. But he was a leading Shia cleric, and he was also one of the people who most vigorously championed the rights of the oppressed Shia minority in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia. It was also an execution that was carried out at the same time as the execution of 43, I think, convicted Al-Qaeda operatives who had been allegedly involved in carrying out terrorist attacks many, many years before. Some of them had been in jail for over 10 years. So the idea, apparently, of the regime was to balance the execution of Sunni extremists with the execution of four Shia, who were alleged to have not just said certain things, but to have done certain things. An attack on policemen was alleged. it's very grave in that it is a blow at a cleric seen as a leader of the community, not just, you know, the execution of somebody who was supposed to have attacked a policeman or called for the downfall of the regime.
Rashid, why are the Saudis so afraid of Iran?
Well, there are three or four reasons. First of all, Iran is a larger country than Saudi Arabia in terms of population. Iran has almost 80 million people. Saudi Arabia has 20-odd million people. A large proportion of them are not Saudi citizens. Secondly, Iran is a highly developed country. It has a massive industrial base. It has a massive, entirely educated population, almost universal literacy, and very large number of highly educated scientists and cadres. Saudi Arabia has nothing to compare with that. It doesn't have the same kind of industrial base. It doesn't have the same kind of depth of an educated population. So that's the second reason. The third reason is that Saudi Arabia can barely defend itself. In fact, it really can't defend itself, in spite of the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been spent on weapons by the regime. Whereas Iran has an extraordinarily robust capability to project power. Iran is a powerful country. It's not just a big country with a strong industrial base and an educated population. It is a country that has turned that into raw power. Saudi Arabia, by contrast, for all of its financial wealth, is extraordinarily feeble. The Houthi rebels in northern Yemen defeat the Saudi army regularly when they're engaged in combat with them. All the money and all the weapons and all the training that the Saudis have are as nothing compared to these, you know, barefoot tribesmen armed with Kalashnikovs. They're not barefoot, but, you know, tribesmen armed with the most simple basic weapons. So that's a third reason. A fourth reason is that Iran constitutes a challenge to the Saudi claim to be a perfect Islamic government. Saudi Arabia claims that Saudi Arabia does not have a constitution, the Quran is its constitution, and it is a perfect Islamic regime. Iran's Islamic Republic constitutes an entirely different model of an Islamic state. And so there's this constant ideological challenge of a different Islamic form. Moreover, Iran is a republic. Iran has a parliamentary regime and elections and so on and so forth, things that are anathema to the absolute autocracy that has ruled Saudi Arabia ever since the kingdom was founded. So the Iranian regime, in its very nature, constitutes a challenge as a republic and as a different Islamic model to the Saudi model. Finally, there's the Sunni Shia element. For the Saudis, Shiaism is a particularly perverse form of heresy and apostasy. For Wahhabism, Shiaism has always been a bugbear. The intolerance of Shia, the hatred of Shia in Wahhabism has always been greater even than the intolerance for non-Muslims. So these are all reasons for Saudi Arabia's fear of Iran, its power, and the challenge that it poses on the political and on the religious level.
Yeah, you know, the foreign minister of Iran, Mohammad Zarif, had an op-ed that the New York Times published, and he writes about the head preacher in the Grand Mosque in Mecca, who said right before the beheading of Sheikh Nimr, he said, "Our disagreements with Shiites will not be removed, nor our suicide to fight them, as long as Shiites remain on the earth."
Yeah. Unfortunately, that sums up a very powerful strain of Wahhabism. You know, the regime has curbed this repeatedly in the past. It has forced the extreme Sunni clerics that it nourishes within its bosom to refrain from carrying out the dire threats that they issue towards the Shia. And at different times in the past has cracked down on Sunni extremists who attacked the Shia population. But at the core of Wahhabism is an intolerance from anything that is seen as taking away from the worship of God. The veneration of men is an abomination. So the veneration of the family of the Prophet, which is one of the central elements in Shiaism, is to Sunnis an abomination. To Wahhabis an abomination. Most Sunnis don't have a problem with that. For most Sunnis, the family of the Prophet is to be cherished and venerated. His son-in-law Ali, his daughter Fatmi, their children Hassan and Hussein, their offspring are, you know, the family of the Prophet. There's nothing in Orthodox Sunni Islam which has any kind, which involves any kind of hostility to that, even if there are doctrinal differences between Sunnis and Shia. But what Wahhabism represents is a visceral hatred of these things as a deviation from a path of the unique worship of God. And that is, this is a profound problem in Wahhabi Sunni Islam, one which is then taken to the extreme by groups like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda in their persecution and murder of Shia.
So how does the extremism of the Saudis entangle the United States?
Well, there has been, ever since Iran and Saudi Arabia became, you know, modern states in the beginning of the 20th century, there's been a rivalry between the two. And the United States used to broker between the two because it had relations with the Shahs, Iran, and with Saudi Arabia. But when the Islamic Revolution took place in Iran in 1979, and Iran became engaged, or the United States became involved in what I call a mini Cold War with Iran, the United States leaned much more heavily in favor of Saudi Arabia. So in this Iranian-Saudi rivalry, the United States has, in effect, not just taken sides, but has egged the Saudis on out of anger at loss of a client and ally when the Shah's regime collapsed, over anger at the treatment of American diplomats during the hostage crisis, over various legitimate and illegitimate grievances that the United States has towards Iran and that the Iranians have towards the United States. And this has led the United States, in effect, to become a party to what is a regional conflict, mostly carried out covertly and rather than overtly in terms of warfare, between Iran and Saudi Arabia. So we've been entangled, in effect, in the Saudi-Iranian rivalry.
Rashid, what relationship does the Saudi government have to the Islamic State?
Well, this is a vexed question. I would argue that there is there's a direct ideological line between Wahhabism and between the ideology of Al-Qaeda. So Al-Qaeda is, in a certain sense, an extreme spin-off from Wahhabism and ideas that developed out of the Muslim Brotherhood through Sayyid Qutb. And Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in turn, spawned the Islamic State. So there's a direct ideological line. But there are other lines as well. One of the most unfortunate aspects of the Iranian-Saudi rivalry is that both have used proxies, many cases proxies, religious proxies, to further their interests. Iran uses militias like Hezbollah and Iraqi and other militias, Shia, sectarian militias, to further its agenda. Saudi Arabia has employed all kinds of extremist, in many cases jihadi and takfiri groups, to further its agenda. And this is true not just of Saudi Arabia, but of other Gulf states, including Qatar. And it's true of the elites of these countries. And you can't distinguish between the regimes and the elites because this is a pre-Magna Carta form of monarchy.
Right.
There are no barons. There is no constitution. There is no parliament. There are no limits on the power of this monarch. L'état, c'est moi. The state belongs to them. They own it. It is Saudi Arabia. The royal dynasty sees the country as coterminous with the royal family. And so when you say private individuals in Saudi Arabia, you're talking about the multi-billionaires, of whom there are dozens and dozens in Saudi Arabia. You're in many cases talking about members of the royal family who don't have any official capacity. Or you're talking about their various relatives and the families allied to them. Al-Sheikh, the family of the descendants of Muhammad ibn Abd Wahhab, the founder of Wahhabism. Or the Bin Laden family. The Sudairi family. I mean, these are families that in some cases are intermarried into the royal family, so they have members of the family who are princes. In other cases, they're multi-billionaires like the Bin Ladens, like the Sudairis, who have profited from their connections to the royal family. And each of these people has a personal budget that's the equivalent of the foreign aid budget of any 20 or 30 middle-sized European countries. And any one of them can play a kingmaker in a small country, or in a corner of a small country, spending tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. To a multi-billionaire like some of these people, 10 or 20 or 50 million dollars is nothing. And so there are scores of militias in Syria that are the playthings of Kuwaiti and Emirati and Saudi and Qatari billionaires. Sometimes these are members of royal families. Some of them are, I think, sponsored by the intelligence services of these countries. And it's impossible to know exactly who is behind what. But we know, if you look at it overall, we know that the petrodollars finance an enormous amount of this, including, I would argue, at certain stages, the Islamic State and other radical Sunni movements in Iraq and Syria.
Rashid, we just have a few minutes left, but could you talk briefly about the Saudi lobby in the U.S., its invisibility and its power?
Yeah, well, anybody who talks about the Middle East is familiar with the debate around the importance and the size of the Israel lobby. And the interesting thing when one compares these two longstanding allies of the United States is that they both have powerful lobbies in Washington. But the Israel lobby, for all of its attempts to, you know, stay under the radar, is well known and clear. We know what it's made up of. We know how AIPAC developed. We know how fundamentalist Christian churches in the South have been organized, and how right-wing, particularly Republican politicians, have become integral to this. What's much less visible is the very powerful interest groups, which fight with all of their strength to maintain the status quo in the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, and which work day and night to shield Saudi Arabia from any scrutiny, any criticism. And when you say, well, who are these people? Well, look at the bottom lines of the aerospace industry. Look at the bottom line of the defense industry. In 2012, two-thirds of American arms sales, it was a banner year, I think over $40 billion, went to Arab Gulf autocracies. I mean, that was a huge part of the bottom line of companies like Raytheon and General Dynamics and so forth. Look at Boeing, or for that matter, Airbus. I mean, where would they be without sales to the Gulf? They have many other markets, East Asia, South Asia, other parts of the world. But this is a huge part of their market. Any change in the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Washington is deleterious, not just to the interests of the companies, but to the personal wealth of every single executive, every single major stockholder. This, and you then go to the oil companies, you then go to the banks, you then go to real estate. How many apartments on 57th Street are owned by Gulf billionaires? And there are obviously others. There are South Asians, there are Chinese, there are Latin Americans, and there are Americans who own some of these multi-million-dollar apartments. But the Gulf wealth is extraordinarily important in the United States and in France and in Britain and in Germany and in other major industrial countries in the West, two very important economic interests. That is the lobby, the Saudi lobby. That is the lobby for Arab autocracy. They don't want any change in the political system of those countries. They don't want any change in the relationship between the United States and Western Europe and these countries.
Yeah, well, I wish that Senator Bob Graham could have heard what you just said, Rashid, because he believes that the Saudi monarchy was involved in the financing and planning of 9/11 and is most frustrated that he can't get that information out. And I think he'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about the strength of the lobby.
Yeah.
It's been great to talk to you. Enlightening. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure, as always. Thank you both.
You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Heidi.
Thanks.
Bye-bye, Michael.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.